Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 15th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks. Joining us on this Friday, executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayan, will be here. Reporter from Mashable and host of Doomed and Majority Report producer emeritus Matt Binder will be joining us. Meanwhile, Nancy Pelosi forces the vote on the crappiest messaging bill ever. Donald Trump pushes for mass suicide as he loses support in the Rust Belt. And Alexander Burr steps down from the Intel Committee in the wake of the FBI investigation into his stock sales. Meanwhile, Kelly Loeffler is asked for documents about her stock sales. Senate reauthorizes expanded surveillance powers, because it's not like Bill Barr will abuse them. And Mitch McConnell concedes there was an Obama administration pandemic plan, whatever. Amazon ends its $2 an extra bucks per hour for hazard pay because it was inhibiting Jeff Bezos from making more than $30 billion. So far during the lockdown. It's only a half a billion dollars a day. Meanwhile, defying a court order, the EPA says we're not going to have limits to fetal and infant neurotoxin in rocket fuel being dumped into water. And lastly, the Texas Supreme Court says, let debt collections and evictions resume. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. I don't know what my daughter has now just texted me and said, do you have music on? I don't know what that's supposed to mean. But it's a madhouse here, ladies and gentlemen, as I'm sure it is in your home. And I certainly hope that it is in your home. Hold on. Now she's, I don't know. Miley, are you listening to the show? Is that what's going on?
That was your pre-show Limp Bizkit.
Yeah, I was listening to your show. Stop talk. Oh, Jesus. Don't use those language. Okay. She said I was S-talking her on her show. 14-year-old girl using that kind of language. There you go.
Rings true, though.
What rings true?
I agree with Mila.
All right. There you go. Matt's kissing Mila's ass. Well, I don't blame you, because it's probably just a matter of days before she's hosting this thing, and I'm permanently retired. But be that as it may, we are here. It is Casual Friday. Welcome. I am wearing a soft-collared shirt. In fact, it is a new shirt that I purchased because I need, I need some summer wear, and it's exceedingly hot in this closet, and so we're gonna have to figure something out about that as well. Hope you're well. Hope you're staying safe. Of course, around the country, there are various states that are opening up. Some by the decision of their governors. Some by the decision of the Supreme Court in like Wisconsin, say, where they say it's going to be time for you to all go out, go to the bars, and hopefully, you know, avoid somehow from catching this disease that's going around that has killed over 80,000 of your fellow Americans. And there are hearings going on. It's been one of the complaints I have about Congress. We'll talk to David Day in a little bit about that. But there are hearings going on. This one is in the Senate. About, I think it was now 2 weeks ago, I had mentioned, or at the very least headlined and maybe touched on, the director of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, which is a governmental agency tasked with developing vaccines and whatnot, Dr. Rick Bright, is now the former director of BARDA. He was removed because he wouldn't get with the program when it came to hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine or whatever it is that Donald Trump was hawking as a miracle cure. Here he is testifying to the Senate committee saying that winter is coming and it's not going to be good.
Without money could be the darkest winter in modern history. First and foremost, we need to be truthful with the American people. Americans deserve the truth. The truth must be based on science. We have the world's greatest scientist. Let us lead. Let us speak without fear of retribution. We must listen. Each of us can and must do our part now. On Tuesday, Dr. Fauci delivered a message in a voice that is clear and trustworthy as he encouraged us to act with caution as we return to our daily lives. We should listen to him and other scientists sharing their expertise. While waiting for a cure and a vaccine, which I believe will come, there are things we must do immediately. We must increase the public education about the basics: washing hands, social distancing, appropriate face covering. They're simple but critical steps to buy valuable time until there's vaccine. We need to ramp up production of essential equipment and supplies, including raw materials and critical components. Shortages of these increase the risk of our frontline healthcare workers, and they deserve the best equipment to protect themselves. We need to facilitate equitable distribution of essential equipment and supplies. And finally, we need a national testing strategy. The virus is here. It's everywhere. We need to be able to find it, isolate it, and stop it. We need to have the right testing for everyone who needs it. We need to be able to trace contacts, isolate, quarantine, and appropriately while striving to develop a cure. Initially, our nation was not as prepared as we should have been, as we could have been. Some scientists raised early warning signals that were overlooked, and pages from our pandemic playbook were ignored by some in leadership. There will be plenty of time to look back to assess what has happened so we can improve. But right now, we need to focus on getting things right going forward. We need a comprehensive plan that everyone knows and everyone participates in.
You know, what strikes me about this is the kind of testimony you would have expected to hear in February or January. Not after 2 months and 80,000 deaths to hear that we have no plans for anything regarding this. None. And to the extent that plans exist, and they certainly do, I mean, there's a 65-page pandemic playbook. There's, I don't know, tens of pages of documents the CDC has put out in terms of guidelines and how to, all of it's being ignored. Consciously, purposely ignored. It's just, it's insanity. We've got a couple more clips of Dr. Bright. We'll play those later in the program. But it's nuts right now what we're seeing in terms of our failures in government, both in terms of like the executive branch and frankly, and we'll talk more with Dan about this, from the legislative branch, at least from a political standpoint and an oversight standpoint. Well, what can you do? I don't know. Meanwhile, Majority Report is made possible today in part by Skillshare. The first 500 people go to skl.sh/majorityreport8 are going to get a free premium membership to Skillshare for 2 months, two whole months. I've talked about Skillshare many times. Online learning community offers thousands upon thousands of cases, almost any topic you can imagine. Drawing, painting, photography, video editing, web design, running a small business, playing the ukulele. In fact, I was saying to Matt before the show, I was like, I cannot get rid of this buzzing. I've got two different systems set up. I have done everything that everyone has suggested to me. I have switched computers. I have changed the power outlets that they're involved in. I have put those little magnet things on the cables that are going in. I have switched out my second mixer. I mean, I suppose I could switch out the main mixer, but I'm not going to do that. I've switched different cables. I've gone from stereo cable, whatever. I'm not going to go through all this. But then it occurs to me, like, I need to take some classes on audio engineering. And I went over to Skillshare just right before the show. I did this. And they have, I don't know, more than a dozen, maybe two dozen, more than that, three dozen, more than that. They've got hundreds. I don't know, hundreds, but they've got a ton of classes that I can take on learning how to mix some audio and some basic understanding of this, which one would have expected I would have done after 15 years in this business. But what are you going to do? Anyways, I'm sure all of you can benefit from learning new skills, getting better at old skills. I don't know. The great thing about Skillshare, it's all like in bite-sized pieces too, little chapters. So you can take chapter one and chapter two and then come back to it later. All classes are, I think, under an hour, more or less. Membership to Skillshare costs less than 10 bucks. Or excuse me, is 10 bucks a month, less than 10 bucks a month. And it gives you access to their entire library classes. But the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majorityreport8 are going to get a free membership for two whole months. I put up the link under the YouTube description here, and I put it up on the podcast description as well. Meanwhile, also, you want to better yourself? You want to catch up on maybe some history books that you haven't read? I don't have the time to read. I've talked to you about this. There's a whole set of a category of books that I just want to get the main points of. And Blinkist is the app that allows me to do this. It takes the best key takeaways, all the need to know information. They do it from thousands of nonfiction books, how-to books, history books, political books. Boils them down in just 15 minutes. So you can read them or you can listen to them on your phone. You can listen to them on your tablet, your web browser, whatever it is. You need to get the important takeaways from a book. You're busy because your kids are gone insane. You're locked inside here and you don't have time to actually sit down and get access to all this stuff. Blinkist is the way to do it. I've said many times, my favorite one is the 4-Hour Work Week by Tim Ferriss. That was really helpful to me. And I would not have in a million years, with all due respect to Mr. Ferriss, read the entire book. Those books, there's a couple of books they have on how horrible Republicans are by Republicans. I checked that out. Everything Trump Touches Dies by Rick Wilson. Also, there's another one. Jared Diamond has some books about how societies fail, and I'm interested in looking at that. They've got Turning Points for Nations in Crisis by Jared Diamond. I interviewed him a long time ago, years ago on the Majority Report, but this is a good way to catch up on the latest book. With Blinkist, like I say, you get unlimited access to a massive library of these condensed nonfiction books. And for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for just our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majorityreport. You try it for free for 7 days. You save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majorityreport. Start your 7-day free trial. Save 25%. Sign up now at Blinkist.com/majorityreport. Again, that link will also be in our podcast description and YouTube description. And lastly, there would be nothing better now And it's not going to happen for my kids. Sorry, Milo, if you're listening to this right now. But one of the good things that's happening is this big pet adoption boom that's going on right now. Shelters are being cleared out and people are getting dogs. They're getting, you know, mutts, dogs they don't know much about. Well, Embark's breed and health test is the best way to get to know your dog, whether it's old or new for that matter. The thing about Embark is it teaches you not just about what your dog's breed is, who their cousins are, but it also, most importantly, tells you about the genetic risk factors that the dogs have for any type of proclivity or propensity to get any type of disease. Embark can identify over 250 breeds. It screens for 175 genetic health conditions. So over 50% of dogs are either at risk or a carrier of a genetic disease. Embark will help you learn their history. What do you do with that information? Well, you go to your vet and your vet tells you this dog needs this kind of food. Or you tell your vet this and your vet is looking out for different cancers or different diseases that they may not have known. They probably knew broadly what breeds are sensitive to these things, but they may not have known what breed your dog was. We have now been advertising for Embark for, I don't know, over a year. And so I'm starting to get feedback from listeners on this. I already told you a story about listener Aaron. They've got a dog, Gregor, who is Aaron's brother's best friend. And his brother has had, you know, socialization issues over the year, and Gregor, their dog, became a lifesaver for this kid, like a social lifesaver, as it were. And knowing Gregor's potential problems with his genetics in terms of feeding him, and just knowing stuff about Gregor has been a huge boon for that family. Kelly, she looked into Edie's genes. She tested clear for all 171 genetic health conditions they screen for, and she's not a carrier or a risk for any of the genetic diseases they test. There's also a full clinical trial report. Great news. Most importantly, I can provide the report to her vet, which will provide so much information with Edie's health as she grows up. And then we got a tweet from Melancholy on the MRIM. Looking at all the cousins of her dog from Embark. It's nuts. Right now, Embark has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. You go to EmbarkVet.com now. Use the promo code MAJORITY to save 15% off your dog breed and health kit. Visit EmbarkVet.com, EmbarkVet.com. Use the promo code MAJORITY, and you'll save 15% today. All right, quick break, and then we're going to go talk to David Dayan in just a moment. Be right back.
We'll be right back.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program David Dayan. He is the executive editor of the American Prospect. David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Can you hear me? Do I sound okay?
It's not the greatest, but I'll muddle through.
All right. Well, fair enough. You're a real trooper. I don't know why that's the case, but hopefully it'll be better next time. David, so you have a piece in the, well, you have a couple pieces I've been reading, frankly, and I should just say, let me just, I think I pay this compliment to you, every time you come on, but the American Prospect is killing it these days in a myriad of different ways. And so thank you for the work you're doing there. I frankly get a lot of the information that I talk about on this program from there. You have a great piece about Joe Biden. Well, I want to get to that in a moment, but let's talk about the HEROES Act. Can you, for a moment, explain to me what in the world is the idea behind this thing? Like, it's a messaging bill, but it's sending out a very bad message, and I don't know who it's sending it out to.
I am completely baffled by this bill. You know, when it initially was conceived, even Nancy Pelosi herself said this is a bill to set a marker for negotiations. This is a messaging bill. This is, you know, this represents what we want to happen. You know, you always hear politicians say, this is not the bill I would write, but, it has some good things in it and I'll pass it. Well, this is the bill I would write. Like, if you're Nancy Pelosi, this is the bill that she would write. That's what a messaging bill is. This is, here's everything I want. And then we'll go into a negotiation with Republicans and see what we get. But this is supposed to be the bill I would write, right? And yet it is like completely muddled with things that look like compromises with Republicans, things that look like compromises with special interests, trimming of sales to hit, this is the weirdest part, to hit like a budget number to make sure it's not too expensive when it's a $3 trillion bill. The idea that you're trying to save money by clipping coupons on a buying of a yacht, essentially, on a $3 trillion bill is insane. And so it's like everything and nothing at once. And it reflects the total incoherence of Democratic policy. I mean, if you sat Nancy Pelosi down and asked, well, what do you want out of politics? I'm not, if this bill is any indication, I'm not sure she could tell you. It doesn't make any sense. And that's why it has all this mixed messaging in it. And that's why it's going to be very difficult for swing district members to justify it, because there's so much in this bill that is going to be demagogued in November, no matter which way they vote on it.
Right. I'm completely flummoxed by this. The only explanation I can come up with this is, and you know, the student loan thing is a perfect example of it, but also the COBRA stuff. And just the idea of ending the COBRA stuff randomly on January 21, 2021 also seems just like, this is sort of like the classic, like the food sucks and the portions are too small type of situation. And the only thing that occurs to me is that the central agenda here is to project that we're doing stuff, but to make sure that really nothing happens, there is no implications of this. Like we have, the Republicans are out there. It seems to me they are full bore going for some structural change, right, to exist after this is over. And the Democrats are just like desperately trying. And by Democrats, I just mean, you know, Nancy Pelosi and a handful of her friends, because nobody else is allowed into this process, it appears.
Right.
Are desperately trying to make sure that nothing, there is no progressive structural change that comes out of this. That seems to be their primary, agenda. Make it look like we're doing something and make sure there's
the fact. But I mean, just the fact that you think that there's a primary agenda here, I just disagree with that. I don't think there's any agenda here. It's slap a bunch of words onto a page because I don't have any vision for what I want to accomplish and try to please every element of the caucus at the same time, which inevitably creates contradictory messages that infuriate the rank and file. I mean, there is no coherence here. $1 trillion for state and local governments, rent cancellation or rent forgiveness, $100 billion for rental subsidies. There are some, things that are very important. Maybe they're not structurally important, but they're very important to get us through this, incredibly difficult period. And then there's we saw the score from CBO and we decided that student loan thing was too generous. So we're going to scale it back so that we can say the bill is $3 trillion instead of $3.1 trillion. Because that 3% of the total cost of the bill would really, really take us into fantasy territory, I guess, from $3 billion to $3.1 billion. It doesn't make
well, any but that's
sense.
But that's my point, that it's not about the dollars, because if it was about the dollars, right, you would jettison, let's say, the SALT stuff. It's not about the dollars. Well, it's about
if it was about the dollars, you wouldn't be subsidizing COBRA instead of putting people on Medicare.
Exactly.
That is demonstrably much more expensive.
Exactly.
By about 50% per person than the alternative. So it's only some of this is just straightforward special interest corruption. And that's certainly one of them. The fact that they're going to allow trade associations to take, these paycheck protection program, funds, these forgivable loans. There's a report by the Democratic Policy Center showing that existing members in Congress have taken $191 million in donations from trade associations. So that's just straight up corruption. They're just like, okay, our future employers or the people that fund our campaigns, you can get free money from the government. Why not? So some of it, I mean, this is my point. There's things that are necessary. There's things that have been tailored to please one random, swing state district member in the Midwest or something. There are things that are just favors and giveaways to special interests. It's not coherent. It's just incoherent.
I still contend that the coherence is when you look at like the COBRA thing, when you look at the student loan thing, the one message I get from that, and I'm not saying there aren't these other conflicting messages and whatnot, but the one message I get from that is cost is not the issue. The issue is creating a plan that could actually go forward after we're done with this. Like, they don't want the benchmark of allowing these things to exist, even on paper. Right. In the same way that, like, if they were to vote expand Social Security in the Senate, we're all looking at that as a, obviously the Democrats were not in power when they passed that, but it's a marker. If they say in this bill, expanded Medicaid is better than publicly financing COBRA, then why isn't that the case a year from now? If they say loan forgiveness is doable under a pandemic, why isn't that the case a year from now? And I think that this is like just the one sort of guiding principle, to the extent that there is one, is just we got to make sure that there's nothing in here that we're going to have to try and unwind after the fact if Joe Biden becomes president.
I don't know. I think by virtue of seeding the public with trillions of dollars, that's going to have a long-term impact. By extending unemployment insurance that gives low-wage workers at the low end not just 100% replacement of their salary, but 150% replacement of their salary in some cases, that's going to be important. That's important for worker power.
Yeah.
In terms of when they come back. So I think that, you know, it's like the Federal Reserve said, hey, Congress really has to spend a lot of money. And then Pelosi says, oh, now it's okay. It's like she has this brain that only thinks in these very narrow terms and doesn't have any kind of strategic vision. So, she's basically saying, well, the Fed told me it was okay to spend money, but the special interest told me that they wanted this. And my swing district member told me that this was too ambitious. And I'm also trying to please this side. And I'm also trying to please the Congressional Black Caucus by making more minority businesses available for PPP. It's just transactional, siloed, ridiculous Democratic thinking that has no strategic outcome or opportunity. I don't think it's as conspiratorial as you think, because I think that the Democrats are too stupid to be that conspiratorial.
Yeah, I mean, I think
they're thinking beyond the you know, 5 feet in front of them.
No, I include that element, that principle, in the litany of ones that you just did, which is I've got to make these people happy and I got to make those people happy. It's just not happening when it comes to, progressives. I mean, that's the one, like, she shuts down Jayapal's, proposal. She shuts down the loan forgiveness. She shuts down, expansion of Medicaid. I don't think that's just a coincidence. I think those just fall into the bucket of, you know, it's bigger than just turning a spigot on and turning it off. I mean, it's going to be the easiest thing in the world after the coronavirus to say unemployment benefits are not going to include 110% of what you got paid. That's going to be the easiest thing in American politics to dial back. What wouldn't be easy would be things like loan forgiveness. What wouldn't be easy...
I mean, first of all, I'm getting like every fifth word here. This is
all right. Let me call you on a different.
I'm going to conversation with Bane from Batman. Like, just
oh, I set that up that way. Let me call you back on a different device. I'll call you right back.
Okay.
All right, bud. All right, folks. Give us 5 minutes. Give us just a little bit of minutes. I'll be right back.
Okay, cool.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. David Dayen is back with us, hopefully sounding a little bit better. David, are you there?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. So you were just about to totally agree with my premise about Nancy Pelosi trying to basically block anything that might be structural in some way, like any artifice that's going to exist after the
Look, I know what you mean, and you know, I'm not disagreeing with that completely out of hand, but the point is that if you spend $3 trillion and it goes to you know, lower class people, small businesses, and state and local governments, and then on to their employees, that is structural. That because in the absence of that, you're destroying that sector. You're destroying people's livelihoods. You're putting them in a hole they won't be able to come out of. So that is structural. The giving $1 trillion to state and local governments and preventing a depression is structural because depressions have long-term consequences. I'm disagreeing to an extent. There are just a jumble of contradictions in this thing because there's no real thinking about what the goals are wishing to accomplish. It's just sticking a finger in a dike. That's kind of where I'm at with it. And you know, I don't want to let progressives off the hook.
I was just going to say
they don't really have that coherent a theory either. And they certainly don't have any idea of how to deal with Nancy Pelosi. I mean, one of the most embarrassing comments I've ever seen from Representative Pramila Jayapal, who says that she is a no on this bill. Now, she has been fighting with Pelosi because she wanted her idea, which was direct payroll support for all workers rather than trying to push everybody onto unemployment. That wasn't in the bill for a variety of reasons, some of which it was Pelosi just kind of being a tyrant. And so there was this question of, well, is the Progressive Caucus going to sink this bill? Jayapal, of course, is the co-chair. So she gave a quote to Politico where she says she's a no on the bill, but that's not an official position of the Progressive Caucus. Also, she's not whipping Dems against the bill. And then she told the reporter, can you please put that in your story? It's the most embarrassing quote I've ever seen. Like, just not only a refusal to fight, but like foregrounding the refusal to fight. Like, please mention that I'm refusing to fight. You cannot just sort of out of hand condemn Pelosi without talking about the fact the rest of the caucus is incoherent as well.
And I will say that you also you had a piece, I don't know, maybe it was 2 or 3 days ago, that Jayapal was basically had her legs cut out from underneath her by all these outside progressive groups who...
That's correct.
I mean, I think the list was like, was it Move On, WFP, was it others that were basically...
I don't think it was Working Families. I think it was Indivisible and some unions. And I mean, but this, that's just a total lack of communication. Literally those organizations were standing with Jayapal and saying the next bill has to have this, this, and this. And one of those things being the paycheck guarantee, payroll support. And they just jumped out and said, yeah, $3 trillion, yay, we support the HEROES Act. Not seeing this internal fight where Jayapal was trying to get more input on the bill, and it even extends to this. The Congressional Progressive Caucus Center, which is an outside group it's not directly affiliated with the Progressive Caucus, but it's tied to them in some way. They initially tweeted out support of the bill. When their co-chair was vociferously against it. I mean, this is just a total disconnect on the progressive left, or among the professional left, I should say, in D.C. They have no power. They have no understanding. They have no idea of how to build a coalition. It's laughable.
I mean, this is it's stunning. Is this? I mean, is it just that we've always had this absence, or is it just like in this type of environment it becomes most obvious?
I think the latter. Crisis moments, particularly in, you know, the last decade or two, given the gridlock in Congress, crisis moments are when you govern, and they don't come along very often. And clearly they have caught the Democratic policymaking apparatus, to the extent that it exists, completely flat-footed. And, you look at the Republican side. The Republican side wanted one thing. They wanted a corporate bailout. They wanted corporations to be protected amid the pandemic. That's all they wanted. They didn't write a message bill with 30 things like, banning all abortions and guns on demand, or I don't know, whatever it would be. They just wanted the corporate bail. And so McConnell on the CARES Act writes a bill with a big corporate bailout, and other things he trades away. But as long as he gets his corporate bailout, he's happy. So what happens on the other side? Pelosi writes a bill with 300 things in it, and there's no one thing that's an anchor that is the thing that Democrats want, and whether that's structural or not. I mean, corporate bailout isn't necessarily structural. It's a near-term response to the problem, but it will have long-lasting consequences,
right, right.
Because it's a disproportionate response at the top end of the corporate ladder, and it will, create this increasing dominance of large corporations in American life. Pelosi just doesn't have that vision. I mean, this is absolutely the opposite of what Republicans do with governance in a crisis. And so it says to me, and because progressives don't have that vision either, it says to me that vision doesn't exist.
And it seems to me that, I mean, a big part of it is also just a function of the differences between the two parties in terms of how they're made up. And, broadly speaking, with the left, right? I mean, because on the left, there's like 40 different issues that are the most important issue. You want your leadership on some level to be able to sort of coalesce that and say this one or two things are really sort of like, this is how you sequence it at least, or something to that effect. But there's none of that. There's none of that coming from Pelosi. I don't know. Is Chuck Schumer still working? Is Chuck Schumer still with us?
Chuck Schumer's in the minority, and, obviously Pelosi's going to need to take the lead here because she controls the House of Congress. The thing that she likes about having 300 things in the bill is that there's always something for someone to latch onto. So, Progressive Caucus can say, oh, well, we got $100 trillion for state and local governments. That's good. And now we have to weigh that against the bad stuff and on down the line. So they can sort of buy off various interest groups and people within the caucus by giving them the one good thing. This is how legislating has happened since Pelosi took back the chair. I mean, remember H.R. 1? Remember,
yes.
Well,
I barely
sort of
do. I will say, I barely do because they buried it with their own attacks on Ilhan Omar at the time. But yes, I get the point taken.
Right, but what do? They pool together 30 different ideas around some sort of loosely organized principle, and they put this omnibus bill together. And then they throw it over to Mitch McConnell, and he says, I'm not doing anything with this. And then they're shocked that they don't get attention within the public over their great bill that has 30 things in it that you can't describe to anybody. So this is the same style of governing. We're going to do the HEROES Act, which is, the HEROES Act, come on. the whole name. I feel like the preamble should be in these challenging times.
Right. You know,
like
what, the local
what
ad.
Does that even mean?
Yes. Well, and I mean, that is what was so sort of mind numbing about this notion of like, you got to pass it today, because if it's a messaging bill, it seems to me the one thing you would want is people to talk about it, right? Like, to get the message out. They're going to pass it, and then it's going to be dead on arrival by Monday, and it's going to be gone. It's just like, if she wants to be the ability for various different House members to be able to say, I voted for this provision or I voted for that provision, and that's it. There's no message being sent out here.
Exactly. The summary of this bill was 90 pages long. Not the legislation was 1800 pages, but you couldn't even describe what the bill does in less than 90 pages. How is that going to be an effective political messaging tool? It just doesn't make any sense.
All right. Well, let's move on to the other bastion of leadership that we have in the Democratic Party. Chuck Schumer, of course, is in the minority and is super busy. I think that there are, you know, like the width of seatbelts.
I think he's just doing oppo on his potential 2022 opponent, of whom I'm speaking with.
Maybe he's too busy. He's just worried about what Sam Cedar is up to. But at least we have the presumptive nominee, because it would suck if we didn't have a presumptive nominee now, because we wouldn't have that sort of strong voice out there pushing what is actually the Democratic agenda. And that's why I know Pelosi and Schumer are being quiet, because they're trying to defer to our nominee. You've written a piece about him, and it is it's an interesting piece, and it's sort of, I think, like, you know, what my sense of Joe Biden has been, which is there's maybe some opportunity there, but maybe not, and who knows?
Well, I mean, not for nothing, but Joe Biden is the one who came out and endorsed a blanket $10,000 forgiveness on student loans.
Right.
So Pelosi's enough. Bill is now to the right of Joe Biden, just to be clear. This piece that I did called Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Biden I wanted to sort of see if there was a best case for a Biden presidency. And so I talked to the campaign. I talked to several individuals inside the campaign. I talked to people working with the campaign as informal advisors. I talked to progressive groups who have had discussions with the campaign. And I just tried to get a real sense of it. And I tried to look at it holistically, not just about Biden the man, or even Biden the man and his team and his personnel, but also the historical moment. So I conceived of this idea before the pandemic hit, and it was certainly a much different idea at that time. And then when the pandemic hit and the whole world changed, typically those moments create political opportunity, and they sort of move the political system along towards a moment of change. I mean, we're talking about this jumble of a bill, but it is a $3 trillion bill. After right. $3 trillion has already been spent. The idea that Nancy Pelosi, who put in a PAYGO restriction where no new spending could be done without offsets, is now putting out a $3 trillion bill. It shows the transformative power of these kind of cataclysmic events to change the realm of the possible in the political system. And I look back to the last moment like this, which was obviously the Depression, the Great Depression, and found that public anger was so intense and concentrated that individual politicians who were not really given to revolutionary change we're sort of bargaining with the public over how much revolutionary change they would allow. So, you know, I take the example of Glass-Steagall. So Glass-Steagall is named after Henry Steagall, who was the House Financial Services Committee chair, and Carter Glass, who was the Senate Banking Committee chair. Carter Glass was a Democrat from Virginia, so at that time a Southern Democrat. He was a total stooge for the banking industry. I mean, he was seen as the best friend that Wall Street ever had in Congress. And his name is on Glass-Steagall. And the reason it's on Glass-Steagall, which was a severe disruption to investment, you know, separating investment and commercial banking. The banks hated it. They were outright opposed to it initially. The reason it was Carter Glass's idea is that he was bargaining with the public. The public anger was such that they wanted the full nationalization of banking whatsoever. Getting private banks completely out of the equation. Glass-Steagall, this liberal achievement that's made the banking system secure for 50, 60 years, was a compromise. It brought together by a Wall Street stooge. But in that moment, he had to think well outside of his comfort zone and put together this legislation. So I conceive of Joe Biden in those terms, or think about the possibility for Joe Biden to be conceived of in those terms, of someone who certainly throughout his entire political career has not really shown an aptitude for radical, transformative reform agendas. But in the moment where the public itself is going to be given the opportunity to weigh in and say that you know, things have to change in a certain direction, he might be the person to bring about that change, or at least a version of that change. And so I'm not taking sides on this. I really don't know which way it's going to go, because there's a lot of evidence on the other side. You know, the fact that Larry Summers is somehow involved as an economic right. policy informal advisor. The, you know, just Biden's history, as you know, someone who reveres bipartisanship and has done cut pretty bad deals with, Senate Republicans. But the opportunity is there. And, that's what I was trying to express through this feature.
Is there not also a bifurcation of the people that didn't exist at that time? Like we have an ideological difference on whether during a pandemic it's a good idea to go to a bar without masks on, right? I mean, we do in this country. And that, to me, maybe that has been a dynamic that we had at that time, but I don't think it was that deep of an ideological divide. Is there, in addition to not being able to know and there being some hints that maybe he is and maybe he isn't, susceptible to a push from the people, as it were, isn't the other half of that equation that we may not be able to have that coherent of a push?
Roosevelt was almost shot during the interregnum period between winning the election and becoming president. There was this like deep business plot against Roosevelt. The plot against the president, I believe, is the book that details this. There was a right wing that was pretty committed to damaging and eliminating Roosevelt. Now, you know, he had huge numbers in Congress, and that's one of the big differences, I think, that's going to be that even if Biden comes in, even if this is a wave election, certainly in the Senate, you're not going to see the kind of numbers that would give Democrats free reign over the political system. However, that's sort of where the public comes in. And, you know, I'm not saying this is the same political age, but depressions have a way to concentrate minds, and we're not there yet. I mean, we have seen obviously a tremendous amount of cataclysmic events in the economy, but they will compound upon themselves. There, we are not at that moment yet. By next winter, we could be, especially depending on the trajectory of the pandemic. And, you know, things change. Republicans passed this bill that has an unemployment standard where, you know, it's at the low wage, people are making 150% of what they were. That bill passed 96-0, 98-0 in the Senate. You know, possibilities emerge in crisis that weren't there before. And certainly this crisis is exposing how depraved and degraded our social and economic structures were in ways that Biden is talking about. And talking about pretty regularly, and is seemingly aware of, or his advisors are aware of it. So I don't know that the tribalism that you see is necessarily an impediment to what can be done now. And of course, you know, a lot of the New Deal was compromised by particularly. By some of the most tribal impulses ever, by race. White Southern Democrats who didn't want to extend these benefits to black people. So, you know, not everything is going to work out, I think, perfectly, but that was true of the New Deal as well.
All right. So let me ask you this. In the course of your reporting, do you have a sense of you talk about the podcast that Biden has and you capture sort
challenging
of
you in a big way.
He can have it. Come again. Come in here. Anybody, but that comes also with dealing with my kids. But it's also fascinating where you highlight him saying we gotta just make sure that we're stable and that, you know, the way that he's sort of flip flopping back and forth between these different visions. And, my sense of Biden, and this is just like a completely visceral sense. It's just like, it's that scene, you know, where the king is, you know, got consumption and he's in bed and everybody's around him sort of waiting for him to die so they can just like try and take over the kingdom on some level. And I don't mean literally that he's going to die, but I mean, it's just like, there does seem to be a quality of a lot of people are trying to get in there and influence him in a way because there's been this sort of lack of agenda that he did not run on an agenda other than like, I'm going to be dignified. And that hasn't even necessarily gone that well, but he's not run on a massive political agenda. And so there's this perception, there's a vacuum there and people are trying to fill it. Do you have a sense? And is there a way that we can have a sense? Like if we knew that Frohman was picking Obama's cabinet, you know, we would have been on like, I like to think that the progressives would have been in a higher state of alert going into that administration than they were. Do we have a sense of what's going on now in that regard?
I think it's not a perception that there was no policy agenda. It's a reality.
Right. Okay.
The Biden's policy team was almost infinitesimal. And there is a lot of jockeying for position. And this is the thing about a Larry Summers, because, you know, you could come up with a bunch of names and credibly say, that there's kind of a team of rivals situation happening around policy within the Biden campaign. And I'm even putting that separate from these task forces,
right?
This thing that Biden and Sanders put together. It's not clear to me what impact that will have whatsoever. It's just very unclear what that means. What we know is that policy was being set through these daily briefings that Biden has with the economic team. And you can put a lot of names in there. Jared Bernstein is in the room. He was the vice president's economic policy advisor, and he's generally seen as someone on the left. And when the Obama administration wanted to put a token progressive in the economic team, they put it in Biden's office. So, I mean, just that's true. You have Heather Boucher, who's with the Washington Center of Equitable Growth. She's in the mix, progressive economist. Ben Harris, another somewhat progressive economist. But you also have Larry Summers, right? He's in the mix there, and some other people on that, on his side, proteges of his, people like Natasha Saarinen and a couple others. The difference is that it's not something where you line up, okay, there are three progressives and there are three, you know, more moderates, and it's a three versus three, and it's a level fight or even playing field. Larry Summers, what we know, is a consummate sort of bureaucratic infighter who was able to sort of work his way into not just the Clinton administration, but the Obama administration in a position where he knew how to put himself forward to charm or please powerful people and get his agenda through. It's not an even fight, right? If Summers is in the mix. And that's why there's a lot of consternation around that and why groups have said, you got to get him out. So on the other hand, you have Ted Kaufman, who was a longtime chief of staff to Biden and then became senator when Biden left in Delaware. And wasn't running again, so he didn't have to sort of prostrate himself upon special interests like banking interests. And, you know, he ended up fighting the banking.
Industry, he was the best guy in the Senate for, I don't know, I can't remember, 6 months or something like that on these issues.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And he is running the transition. So he is in charge of the presidential transition, which is a big hiring position. A lot of recommendations flow through that transition chair. I think it was Podesta in the Clinton administration. I'm not remembering who it was under Obama. But so, you know, that's a point on the other side of that. So there's a lot of contradictions there. Yeah. And Kaufman, by virtue of being, you know, working for decades for Biden, has his trust in a way that Summers really doesn't. I mean, Summers is new to sort of Biden world. On the other hand, there are people in Biden world like Bruce Reed, who was the head of the Democratic Leadership Council back in the day. And Steve Ricchetti, who literally founded a lobbying firm for healthcare interests. And he's a longtime Biden guy, former chief of staff when he was vice president. So it's unclear from a personnel standpoint, and people on the outside are going to have to keep pushing. You know, this example of Natasha Saarinen and Social Security, are you familiar with this? This happened this week.
She's pushing borrow 10 grand and pay it back later type of deal?
Yeah, so Saarinen is a protege, a former student of Summers, co-authored some op-eds with Summers, and she put out this paper that said, well, one way that would be great without having to spend any money is you allow people to take 1% of their future Social Security earnings and use it now when they need it. So essentially robbing from Social Security for the future and depriving people of that, of those benefits.
That's like
in the future.
It's like a Social Security tax cut, but worse. In terms of what it does, like it's like it cuts out the middleman.
It's like making Social Security a reverse mortgage.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. So the White House sort of picked up on this because there was a separate proposal along the same exact lines from Hoover Institute and the American Enterprise Institute, and the White House started talking about this. And Biden put out a statement like, this is ridiculous. I completely reject robbing from Social Security. And then some of us made the obvious point that your advisor has an academic research paper, not like musing on Twitter, but like put together an academic paper suggesting this very thing. Well, by Tuesday, a day after Biden came out, Sarin put an op-ed in Bloomberg saying that she now has rethought her position. And she lied about it. She was saying, well, I realize that this is bad politics. And what I said was just that this would be cheaper than borrowing from banks, when that's not what she said. She said it would be cheaper than having to spend money as, you know, out of the government. But the point of that is that pressure from the outside can work and move these people, and change, you know, the dynamic in terms of personnel inside the Biden camp.
David Dayen, it is always a pleasure to talk to you. Folks can check out that piece, Dr. Biden or Mr. Jekyll. What is
Dr.
it?
Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Biden.
I mean, I think, look, people get it. People, it's the one with Jekyll and Biden in the headline. Over at the prospect.org, we'll put a link to that piece. But folks, when you're over there, do yourself a favor. Just go to prospect.org. Take a peruse around there. You will see an amazing array of stories that you're interested in. And then what you should do is subscribe and help an organization that is providing that type of content, particularly in this era. David Dayen, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Stay safe. David Dayen, ladies and gentlemen, David Dayen. In the meantime, do we have... I got to do something about that. I don't know what the heck is going on with my audio. I got to take that Skillshare audio class. In the meantime, do we have Matt Binder the Zoom?
Yes, we do. Here he comes.
Can we bring Matt Binder in? Ladies and gentlemen, making his... he's been back. But every time he comes, it's sort of like a triumphant return. Wait, what's going on here? Why don't I hear that? Where the heck is... how come I now my... God, I am just tired of this.
Is it the computer?
No, I don't know what's going on with this. I got, I'm trying to play my fanfare and it's not happening. Thank you. Thank you. That is what I like to see, that kind of like protosorial support. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Binder, can we see Matt, or is that not going to...
I'm coming right on right now. Let me, one second. There we go.
Why isn't my, like, out of the blue, this thing doesn't work now. Jeez, oh, Pete. What the heck?
Civilization collapses around us.
Let me try this. Let's see if this one works. It doesn't make any sense. Whoa, Matt Binder, where are you contacting us from outer space?
Yeah, this is, I see you've never once watched the Doomed live stream.
Oh my God. No, I've seen it on Twitter, but I didn't really, like, what do you got going there? How do you have it all black behind you?
I don't know, I'm just streaming, you know, from the corner of my one bedroom apartment where there's two children and a cat. And behind me isn't all that great.
I don't know.
But listen, it feels weird that I'm like talking with you and I'm not in the office when I'm on the show. So I think I could fix that. You know, let me see. Pandemic be damned.
Oh, good. Sweet.
There we go.
That's fantastic. Well done. Damn.
Well, you know, it's like I'm there. It's like I'm there.
Why is it that Binder can figure this out, but Michael can't?
I think you know the answer to that one.
That's not so hard of a question, actually.
Now, where did you get that image? Had you taken a picture of that image, or
I had taken a picture of this image either the last time or the time prior to that, when I was on the show, and I was like, oh, let me take a picture of this backdrop with no one standing in front of it because it might come in handy in the future.
Nice. Well done. Well, we may have to put that to use going forward. So, what are you doing, Matt? Now, in this, is your kids going crazy or what?
Yeah, like it's, you know, it's harder for the, you know, my, I have a 4-year old Ezra and a 11 month old now. She's almost going to be a year old this month, Enid. You know, she doesn't know what's going on. The baby doesn't know what's going on. In fact, she's probably going to benefit from being around both me and her mom 24/7 when she grows up and have the extra time with us. But the 4-year-old who's turning 5 in July, I'm worried about him. I really am worried about him. I think this is the age where, you know, going to school for him, he loved it, and it wasn't the learning. It was like, he can't do Zoom.
Socialization.
It's the socialization, yes. You know, without his friends to run around with. And it's not the same for these kids of this age to get on Zoom and just see each other, because you know what? They don't talk. They don't have conversation right about what's happening. They interact and play superheroes or whatever they're into. You know, they can't do that over Zoom or any other, you know, webcam thing. So, you know, he's getting really agitated. I can tell it's really, he just wants to watch TV. When he does go out, he doesn't want to go out, even though this was a kid who loved going out, never wanted to be indoors. I worry he's regressing, to be quite honest.
I mean, I am going through the same thing with Saul. It's a little bit different because he has that one. He's like on the tail end of that socialization era. So he has the same issue on FaceTime. Like, I can FaceTime with his friends and they basically just like, you know, look at my Lego. And the other one says, look at my Lego. And then they just turn towards their Legos and don't communicate at all because they don't know how to. Saul has the added sort of like the dilemma of having some consciousness of the coronavirus and some fear now of other people.
My kid went out the first time he went out to go to the store with his mom, and he was wearing a mask, and he noticed that everyone else was wearing a mask and there were less people out. He got really worried, and I think that's when he realized, like, he knows about the coronavirus. He calls it like the new germ or something like that. But that's when it really hit him, and I think that might have been the real push for him not to go, because, you know, now, you know, it's getting nicer out, you know, you don't congregate with people, but go to an open field in a park, you know, spend some time out, get some fresh air, some sunlight. He doesn't even really want to do that. And it's getting me worried about him.
Yeah, it's hard. And there's going to be the generations of kids. I mean, you know, different ages, it's going to impact them in different ways, obviously, but going forward. Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that. You're able to do your show, able to do it with this great backdrop.
All right. You're very distracted by it. I think you're still...
it's awesome. It looks great. I'm so excited by that. I can't even tell you.
You know what? If this gets me on the show more often, then it was all worth it.
Exactly. Boom. Well, the other thing is that my you've been a little bit busy dealing with... You went on Turkish TV...
Straka. I was on with Brandon Straka.
We have this clip. Now we have the whole thing. It's long, but what's the best part? For me, the best part is where he's calling you, he's saying that you're calling him a murderer.
Absolutely. That is the best part. And I mean, on the show, I tried to be more, you know, tried to be more diplomatic and said, I'm not calling you that, but I absolutely was calling him a murderer.
All right. Well, can we play that clip? Can we?
We have that.
Can we go to the? Yeah, this is pretty funny. Now, let me just remind everybody who Brandon Straka is. He is the founding member of Walk Away, which has been a resounding unsuccess in terms of like getting Democrats to walk away from the Democratic Party and vote for Trump. I don't think that there has been certainly no more movement than typically. And he started this campaign, you know, in 2016 or 2017. And by 2018, the Democrats had won the greatest electoral victory on an off-year election in the history of anybody alive now.
I think Blexit was more successful.
Yeah, and, the number of seats that they took was less because of gerrymandering, but the sheer disparity of Democratic votes, which is really all he's working on, right? Like, he's not working in gerrymandering districts or anything like that. For him, it's just like, I'm trying to convince as many Democrats as possible to walk away from Democrats, and they've completely failed. And so now he's sort of like, is he changing his branding, or what's he doing?
Well, his thing now is that he's traveling around the country to each of these end the lockdown protests, and he's trying to make his name off of that. I think he's still pushing walk away. I think that's still his thing. But right now, it's there's a grift in the pandemic, that's for sure. I mean, this is I cover grifters a lot, and this is prime grifting material. I mean, I don't think they've ever been so joyous over something like this before. This is beautiful for all people who find money to be made in the pandemic.
All right, let's play this clip of Straka, who is really upset because you've apparently called him a murderer.
Is it a fair point? I don't know. You tell me. I got on 6 airplanes, 3 going there and 3 going back. I stood in a crowd of 1,000 people in the pouring, freezing rain, which is a prime breeding ground for coronavirus. I'm healthy as a horse.
Pause it for one second. Now, so his argument is, I did not catch coronavirus, so maybe it's fake or something?
Right. I don't know if he thinks it's fake or if it's just not as dangerous. What seems to be the case is you have a rift even between these conservative grifters. You have the ones who believe this is an actual thing, but all the experts were wrong and it's not that serious. And, you know, of course it's real. So some old people and the ill, you know, survival of the fittest. Some people just have to die. Oh, well. And then there's people who just don't believe it's even a thing. Like, they were lied to by Bill Gates and Dr. Fauci and, you know, of course not Donald Trump, the president of the United States, who has all the power in the world.
He's just got to go along with it.
Well, how else is he going to get in there to take down that global pedophile ring if he's not going along with this, right, Sam?
Now, exactly. Now, is it the case that freezing rain and cold is actually a prime breeding ground for coronavirus? Is he making that up?
I mean, I have no idea where that came from. I mean, the belief for a long time when this was first happening was, you know, like other illnesses, you know, less people get sick when the weather's warmer, when it's nicer out. I mean, this was happening in Australia during their summer. It's happening in South America during their summer. They're not in the clear. They're locked down in all over. I mean, I have family in Peru who have been locked down, and even more strict lockdowns there than they have here. And they don't even have even a double digit or even single digit percentage of what we've got.
That may not be a coincidence. And I think part of it is, it seems to me, from what I can tell regarding the weather, is that it may be the case that it is harder to contract outside because the air is not as thick with the coronavirus if you're outside. I've just read that. Obviously, you know, folks, do not change your behavior in any way because I've said that. But
I think there's like a broader thing where, like, yeah, less people do get sick in the summer when it's nicer out or whatever. And this probably follows along with that. But there's no truth to the belief that, like, this will just disappear in the summer months and there's nothing to worry about. Like, people still do get sick in the summer,
right?
Even though it's less. It'll be the same like this. People will still get it. But that second wave probably will happen, you know, after August.
Well, the epidemiologists have told me that it happens 6 months after the first peak. The second peak happens 6 months after the first peak. But put all that aside, because that's just science. Let's listen to the art of Brandon Straka.
Was there at that rally.
You're coming, Matt. What's the problem?
Have you been tested? Have you been tested, Brandon?
I wouldn't be tested because I don't have any symptoms.
Right. You can be an asymptomatic carrier of this, killing people as you go to all these things, as you infect them with coronavirus. We don't know.
So now I'm responsible for murder because I went out and exercised my First Amendment right. I now have to feel guilty and responsible for murder because I am presenting a point of view that is contradictory to the authoritarian point of view that you have, that I must follow your orders, I must follow your guidelines, otherwise I'm a murderer. I want to be clear.
I'm not saying anything on that
in the strongest possible terms. You have absolutely no right to call me a murderer because I'm exercising my First Amendment rights and because I'm standing up for working people in the United States of America. How dare you? Do not say that to me.
My issue is you're using a very specific example. This is just information based on you, one individual, and you're trying to use that to tell people, hey, I'm not sick, so you can go out. Are you a person over the age of 65?
Where were you? Do you have people dying every year of the flu?
Hey, Brandon, I let you talk.
Hold on for one second. Yeah, Matt. Where were you when all these people were dying of the flu? How come you weren't, why weren't you doing anything about that?
I don't know. It's my bad. I guess I'm responsible.
To be fair, I do think that you were copacetic with the flu vaccine that was going around, right?
To be fair, last time I was on the show, I did bring whatever illness I had into the office, if you remember.
I think you did, yes. Matt, you're a murderer. This guy's using the argument that I know a guy who smoked for many years and did not die of lung cancer. Therefore, smoking is healthy for you.
Right.
And then he takes the murderer thing. It's good to see Brandon do this. I guess I can appreciate the fact that at least he is putting in and do we know, is he wearing masks at these things? I wonder if he wore a mask on the plane, because you don't have to on many of these planes. If he actually took six planes, my guess is he would have hit one flight where he wasn't forced to wear a mask. I bet you he did wear a mask.
I don't know. A lot of these, I'll be honest, a lot of these guys are really going out there and pushing with the idea that, wearing a mask is weak.
Emasculating?
It's emasculating. Yeah. Wearing the mask, doing all this stuff is weak. I mean, one of the things at these protests is there are people who are proudly not wearing any masks and just saying it's ridiculous. It's bullshit. It's stunning. It seems like, even if you want to end the lockdown and you think this has all gone too far, you think the easiest thing in the world would just be, look, I'm wearing a mask. I'm taking this precaution. I'll open up now. We could all do this. But I mean, they're just like shooting themselves in the foot by clearly showing that they're not ready to reopen up by not being able to follow these very simple rules that will allow them to live their lives, as close to life before the pandemic as possible.
And to be clear, you don't wear a mask at one of these things. I mean, I suppose if you have if you have a good woodworking mask, your mask could be effective in preventing you from getting it. Although there's a doctor who's an NBC contributor who's in the hospital now who's convinced that he got it on a plane through his eyes because it was so packed in that plane.
Right.
But the bottom line is you wear a mask because you're protecting other people. And that is just the worst thing you can do, folks, is having to protect other people. Then you're basically conceding to this entire communistic perspective on society.
Right. I mean, the mask is the one thing that helps solve what you can't do anything about. Like, you don't want to wear gloves. That's fine. You could be careful. It's hard. I mean, people touch their face all the time and touch things, but you can theoretically go through, constantly using hand sanitizer, not touching things. You can't control the particles in the air. You will get someone sick or you yourself will get sick without having to do anything because you just walked into it and it got into your eye or your nose or your mouth. I mean, that's why the mask is the most important thing.
So what else have you been following? Other things? We should say that I think you may be unrivaled in terms of following the right-wing grifters over the years. You introduced me to Mike Cernovich, and then Mike Cernovich introduced me to a world of renown and fame. And
right.
I hope he's doing well during this. Is he still around? What's he doing now?
I honestly, he's completely fallen. A lot of the guys who helped get Trump where he is, didn't quite get anything in return, really. There's, you know, what you basically have is the right is in shambles, all sorts of different, well, at least the far right is in shambles. Obviously, if you look at our government, that's not the case, but the far right and the movements surrounding that are in shambles. They are in various different subgroups. A lot of them have gotten banned. So, you know, a lot of them aren't part of the discourse online, on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube, like they were in 2015 and 2016. So they're not as, you know, out there as they were. But one thing that is, that we are dealing with that wasn't there in 2015 and 16 is QAnon. And the problem with QAnon is that there are no single individuals to ban. And it has grown to a point where it has gone beyond cult. It is a religion now. QAnon is a religion. And the people who follow QAnon are responsible for pretty much all of these conspiracies that you see. I mean, they are deep into the pandemic conspiracies. They're
pandemic, right?
Yes, yes. 2 weeks ago, I had Jared Holt on the show from Right Wing Watch, where we both watched, not Plandemic, but we both watched, there was another QAnon movie that came out that basically broke QAnon down, and it's from the perspective of the QAnon followers. And we watched that and did like a watch party with that, commenting on it throughout. And, you know, they are beyond saving or even like getting through or convincing otherwise. It is literally a lost group of people. This isn't even like, you know, when we talk about white supremacists and there's like the young people who get thrown down the YouTube rabbit hole who just need to be turned on to the right people, listen to some good leftist commentary on YouTube and talk with some leftist friends and they could be taken back. We are beyond that. QAnon has split up families. We're talking parents and kids no longer talking. Relationships over. QAnon is now a religion and they are...
Will you tell people what it is? I mean, I think of a lot of like, you know, a decent amount of our audience are sane and also don't spend their time, you know, sort of digging into this. Will you tell them what it is?
Sure. So QAnon grew out of Pizzagate. Pizzagate was the conspiracy theory that when the Podesta emails leaked from Wikipedia, from WikiLeaks, not Wikipedia, don't confuse the two, from WikiLeaks and right before the 2016 election, conservatives, right-wingers realized that there were a lot of references to pizza. Now, I don't know why a campaign would order so much of a food that's quick, easy to eat, on the move, and everybody loves. I don't know why, but they do. And they thought that the only logical explanation for pizza being mentioned so much in these emails is that they are code words for a pedophile ring. Different toppings mean different types of children. Different references to different places mean different sorts of routes or whatever. And it all sort of took them to Comet Pizzeria, a popular pizza joint in Washington, D.C. And the belief from that was that there is a major pedophile ring that's being run out of the Comet Pizzeria in D.C. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure, one of my favorite movies of all time, but that movie's premise is that Pee-wee believes that his stolen bike is hidden in the basement of the Alamo, and he goes to the Alamo and finds out that there is no basement in the Alamo. Well, for this, QAnon needed an armed individual to travel with his gun, go into the pizzeria, basically force them to show him that there is no basement to the Comet Pizzeria, and that's what I guess would have convinced most people. Pee Wee Herman, at least, was convinced his bike wasn't in the non-existent basement. Not so for the QAnon people. They moved on to, there's got to be more, and they moved on to the QAnon conspiracy. Now, what happened with this was the same people...
Now, let me just say this. It obviously wasn't a random reference to pizza, because if you're getting the... If the child prostitute ring is out of a pizzeria, that's why they called it pizza.
Right.
If it had been in a burger joint, it would have been, what kind of burger do you want?
Right. Obviously, whenever you're doing these things...
I just want to be clear on that.
Right. Whenever you're doing these things, these illegal rings that... would end your life and career and who knows what else. You want to be as explicit as possible what it is you're doing.
And you want to broadcast it to all the people on your campaign, because everybody knows you never join a campaign or get into any type of professional situation unless you share the same criminal conduct, perversion, whatever you want to call that.
It's like Obi-Wan Kenobi hiding from the Sith for years under the secret name of Ben Kenobi. Mm. You know, no one could figure that out.
Right. That was... all right. So now, so that is the Pizzagate, and then they move on. And I will say that in college, I did a thesis on Milanistic cults, and you know, they think the world is going to end on a certain day. And then that day comes, and the world, you know, at least up to this point, it did not end. And they like, it didn't end because of this that happened. And therefore, it's actually, it's not January 16th, it's June 16th. And it's not 1989, it's actually 1996 that we have to wait for. And the cult in no way seems to be harmed by their failure to predict the end of the world, even though everybody sold off all their stuff or whatever. And so right. This is sort of like that, right? So right. After Pizzagate fails, QAnon takes on like a whole nother narrative.
Right. So there obviously has to be a global pedophile, right? And so
I think there may very well be.
There is for sure. But of course, it's another instance where, you know, the answers of, you know, the problems are right in front of them and they're coming up with some crazy conspiracy to find out what's going on. Like, you know, with Alex Jones and the Bilderberg group and the lizard people.
Right.
I mean,
right.
The answer really is that there are very powerful rich people who pull a lot of the strings because they influence policy. It's not really all that hidden, to be quite honest with
right.
you.
They're not, you know, lizards.
Right.
I mean, that's what we used to say on the program, was that if Alex Jones didn't exist, the CIA or the Bilderberg group would invent him just as a way of like throwing people off the trail as to like, yes, you actually do have some power to influence the world we live in. Instead, Alex Jones feeds people all this stuff like they're changelings, they're lizard people. And, you know, we're all controlled. They control the weather through a machine. And basically, it disempowers everybody. And this right. QAnon thing on some level feels sort of like that as well.
Right. So I don't know if you remember that first year of Trump's presidency. I don't know if you want to remember that. But there's that early press conference where he's in front of all those military people. And he makes this vague mention to, you know, this is just the calm before the storm.
Yes.
And a lot of people at that time thought, you know, is Trump planning on, you know, launching a war or something? But to the QAnon, the people who would be the Pizzagators, who would become the QAnon people, to them, that was something different. That was a hint that Trump is now involving himself in all this. And they basically concoct the story that there's this secret war being waged behind the scenes between Donald Trump and his closest confidants against the deep state. And this global pedophile ring made up of, you know, the very wealthy in the world. Hollywood, of course, plays a major role, and Democratic politicians. And they believe the reason it's called QAnon is because this information they're getting that sort of helps them form this worldview is coming from an anonymous individual who originally started putting these vague posts up on 4chan. But it was so crazy for even 4chan, where basically the alt-right and all these racist personalities basically made their name for themselves in the lead up to the 2016 election. QAnon was so crazy that 4chan didn't even want it. So they got pushed off to 8chan, which 8chan is basically the image board where all the mass shooters go to tell people they're about to commit a mass shooting
right.
before they actually go ahead and do it. So QAnon basically lived there, and this anonymous individual or individuals, we don't know, there's all sorts of speculation who or how many people are behind it, would just leave these really vague, you know, comments that basically anyone can parse anything out of. It's so vague. And that's where you sort of get this QAnon conspiracy, where it's this broader thing where, yes, Trump versus the world to take down this global pedophile ring, and everything Trump does is for a reason to take down this global pedophile ring. But because of the vague stuff Q's posting, you get all these other weird conspiracies that get birthed out of it. There's a conspiracy that JFK Jr. is still alive, actually, and is a secret Trump supporter who's helping Trump behind the scenes and just waiting for the right moment to come out and convince all these Democrats to vote for Trump by showing that he's still alive. And of course, you know, you're JFK Jr. Whatever, you know, whatever you say, the Democrats will do.
What was he doing for those other 15 years before
just
Trump
hiding,
won? Just hoping that Trump would win?
There's people who think that there are individuals who foresaw the Trump win years and years and years before. Well, remember, Trump's been saying since what? Right. Early 2000s, I mean, at least.
So, you know, do we know how many adherents there are to QAnon?
It's unclear because, you know, there is no real, like, you know, like meeting point for them. There are big Facebook groups with, you know, a couple thousand people, maybe even the tens of thousands of people. But, you know, they're not like a group that has meetings like, you know, when Richard Spencer had an official alt-right that would come and meet, or, you know, the Ku Klux Klan would have their meetings or whatever. You can't even really tell the subgroups because, you know, it's all just so dispersed. And the weird thing is that you'll notice when you see the Trump rallies, because the QAnon thing is officially gone from, you know, internet conspiracy to you see the Q signs when there were still Trump rallies being held. What the weird thing is this is something that was birthed on these image boards that are known for basically, you know, preteens trolling with stupid racist memes, and then actual legitimate, like, movement racists trying to turn those, you know, troll racists into actual racists, you know, and actually do something, spark some sort of shooting or something. This is an audience that's mostly, I would say, under the age of 40 to be you know even to be generous there. How these boomers, and it's a lot of boomers, took to this is beyond me, and I think it shows just how the QAnon movement went into the mainstream sort of, you know, conspiratorial right wing diaspora. And whatever that word is, and
diaspora,
thank you. And the boomers don't know the difference between real news and fake news. Sorry, boomers who are listening, but there are studies that show young people can actually tell fake news at a much better percent. You know, young people can tell, and boomers are more susceptible to it.
I think older people, frankly, are not used to the idea that, total lunatics have as much access to broadcasting information as, you know, the same network that had Walter Cronkite. Like, I mean, you have access to the same tools. The bar to entry is so low there that I think, you know, you can't, I think you grow up. I mean, I just remember, you know, my grandmother, who was not a boomer, she was much older than that. I remember shooting some video at a holiday. She was very concerned and she called me. She's like, you know, did it come out? And I'm like, I don't know what you mean. Did it come out? Like, did you know, because, and it used to be that you'd take some film and wouldn't, you know, some, like half the time it just didn't come out. And I'm like, no, it's video, grandma. It's there. I knew we got it the moment I recorded it.
Right.
And that like occupied like a year and a half of our conversations, just her amazement at that structure. And I think like there's a quality of, you know, the idea that like, wait, some dude who's just playing a prank on everybody has the same essentially amplifying system for this news as.
Right.
So let me ask you this. Because we got to move on to. Do you think that after the Trump presidency, some guy or girl or guys or girls or a mixture of the two could be a co-ed effort? Are going to come out and announce like we're part of the, you know, the Smelly Footlockers. We're an improv troupe from Ohio, and we decided to do this like 3 years ago. It just took off, and so we did it. And
I mean, I feel like at this point, if that was the case, I feel like even those people would have come out already and just been like, "Listen, we can't keep this going on because there are people showing up and shutting down bridges with their cars and strapped with bombs and they have guns. And I mean, this has happened. Right. This has happened. Like, it's getting to the point where I think if it was all just, you know, a joke or, you know, a prank, it would have come out. What's probably the more realistic is that, this was a bunch of, you know, far right grifters who knew this was all bullshit, had nothing to do with anything. And it went much further than they thought. And, you know, why get rid of that audience? I mean, why not just continue to keep it going? I mean, they probably have a completely unaffiliated website that pushes this stuff. And that's how they get their own content. They're creating the content that they end up reporting on later on. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
All right. Lastly, why have you not tried to monetize this? Like, why do you not have a merch shop? And then maybe you do and you just won't tell us. But why don't you have like a merch shop of like Q is coming or something like that? And like the one thing that sticks out for me in this type of situation is there's a lot of money on the table.
And, right.
You could slowly, like I was going to back in the day during Obama, there was this video going around that they were selling on like Alex Jones and this and that, like the true, the real Obama story. And I was going to do one that would sound just like this documentary because it's all images and just a voiceover, but it would basically just push people to the conclusion that what we really need is a healthcare system where everyone is covered and the government pays for it, but Obama will never give you that. And I'm convinced I could have made thousands of dollars on that.
Right. All right. Well, why didn't you do it?
I was just too busy.
Too late. Yeah, I don't know. I think I'd feel bad. Like, I think I would actually, it would.
Oh, I wouldn't have felt bad.
I don't know. Like, cause I wouldn't want to, I wouldn't feel bad for those people. I think I'd feel bad making profit off of things that are harming individuals, not so much taking
that
money.
Well, you'd have to do a little bit of thing in there just to make yourself feel good about it. But I think
I could do that and like donate half of the proceedings to like, you know, the DSA or some other leftist group. And that could probably make me feel good knowing that money is going to, right now I could give money to people who need it during the pandemic. You know what? Maybe that would make me feel really good. So that's really
easy. Time to start. Brought to you by QAnon.
Maybe it's time to look into that. You know, a lot of people are starting to sell those. This is a problem. I was about to say a lot of people are selling like customized face masks now with like your favorite team printed on it. Problem is, though, the QAnon people don't believe the face mask stuff.
That's right. They're not going to buy those.
Right. But Trump is selling them. Have you seen that? Trump is selling Trump face masks in the Trump shop.
We're going to come out with face masks that just say your mask protects me. My mask protects you. That way it's basically... Because my experience has been when I'm out with a mask on and I see other people not wearing it, I just want to say, hey, you're an effing asshole. Explain it. It's actually be printed on the mask.
Right. How often do you see people without?
Huh?
Because around here where I am in Flushing, Queens, like the heart of, America's Chinatown, everyone's been wearing a mask since before this pandemic. So.
Yes. Not the case in the more rural parts. I can tell you that. There's a lot of like machismo involved and like, I don't have to worry about that. And it's like, well, dude, I'm not worried about you. You worry about you. I'm worried about me. And that's why you're not wearing the mask is a problem for me. And so that's what we're doing with those masks. But, QAnon mask, it could be something to the effect of like, why? My mask is protecting you from a fraud.
Maybe the way to get them to wear masks is to say every dollar that you spend for a QAnon mask goes to taking down the global pedophile ring that Trump, it's funding Trump's war to take down the global pedophile ring and to send those Democrats and Hollywood celebrities to jail.
This mask is not for coronavirus. It's to put Hollywood in prison.
Right.
Matt Bender, folks should check out Doomed. Where is that available? Where can I find this?
Yeah, the audio version is at doomedpod.com, and then the live streamed version is at youtube.com/Matt Bender. Everyone should go subscribe to that YouTube channel right now.
Go subscribe to it. Do you got a Patreon?
I do have a Patreon, patreon.com/Matt Bender. If you can afford to do so during these troubling times, I feel bad asking, but if you, if you can, subscribe.
Matt, always a pleasure. Thanks, buddy. Great backdrop.
Thank you. Take care,
Sam. Hope to see more of that in the future. All right.
I hope you see more of it, too.
Matt Bender, ladies and gentlemen. Matt Bender. Thanks, buddy.
Take care.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half. Quickly, we'll come back. We'll take some IMs. Maybe we'll take a couple phone calls. We got a lot of sound to get through. A lot of clips. We'll be right back. We should probably do this. I want to remind you that Embark Breed and Health Test is the key to unlocking your dog's unique breed mix and genetically informed health needs. You can identify over 250 breeds, screen for over 175 genetic health conditions, to help provide the best medical care for your dog. Go to EmbarkVet.com now. Use the promo code MAJORITY to save 15% off your dog breed and a health kit. It's EmbarkVet.com. Coupon code MAJORITY. And just a reminder, this program relies on your support. If you can become a member, please do join themajorityreport.com. Also, check out the AM Quickie. We're still doing that bad boy every morning. Get a little jump on the big stories of the day. A lot of news going on. A great way to organize it. AMQuickie.com. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off of that. Look at this. I'm going through like a full pot of this almost every show now, and I'm loving it. I don't know why I wasn't doing this full pot of coffee every day. That's what I'm taking out of this thing, Jamie. I'm doing just a full pot of coffee. I have gone through, I think, like 7 pounds of just coffee. I've done the Majority Report blend. I've done Bike Fuel and Los Diosos.
Pots.
What's that?
Soon you'll need 2 pots a day.
Maybe soon. I'm trying to build a habit. Hey, what is Jamie low on your end, guys?
She is a little bit, but her mic always kicks up stronger after it warms up a little bit.
So. Yeah, get your mic warmed up there. Jamie, yeah, what's happening on the Antifada?
Yes, this week on the Antifada, we have a hot, fresh episode of History is a Weapon with Sean and Matt Chrisman from Chapo Trap House. I listened to it last night. It was very good. They made a pretty convincing case that this might be the end of the American experiment. They really crush up the black pill and snort it, and then they come out the other end and get somewhat hopeful again. It's a wild ride. So,
is that the only thing that they crushed up and snorted in that program? Or
No comment.
There you go. Your microphone's now warming up.
And we also have a panel that Andy and I moderated. Sorry, my cat's being really annoying. For Red May Seattle, a virtual edition on coronavirus and the future of work, featuring Aaron Bonanov, Andy McClanahan, and Magali Miranda. Also, Sean did a crossover episode with Terrence from Trillbilly Workers' Party on Origi and World Systems Theory. So check that out. It's in the Trillbillies feed. Thought it was going to be in our feed today, but it's not. Oh, well. Also, I still must highly recommend our episode with Assad Haider, a super smart, super amazing Marxist that we released last week, week before last. Time is an illusion. Yes. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Also, folks, don't forget TMBS. Matt, what happened? You took a vacation last night.
Yeah, Michael was feeling a little bit under the weather yesterday, so we didn't have anything, but I think we're going to be doing some streaming on Sunday.
What does he have?
It's not, I don't believe it's coronavirus-related symptoms, so hopefully he's feeling a little bit better
crossed.
Today.
Folks can check out the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube, and you can go to patreon.com/TMBS. Also, don't forget to watch our friend Nomiki's show. Nomiki Konst at YouTube and on Patreon.com, the Nomiki Show. Nomiki Show. Oh, what's wrong with me? Also, of course, we have Lotterary Hangover. Lotterary? Am I saying that wrong?
Are you okay?
No, I'm just trying to. I'm trying to cover for the fact that I can't say Nomiki's name. I say it like that, but when I gear up,
you got the yips. You're like Chuck Knobloch.
Yeah, it's true. Knobloch.
True. I'm like Knobloch.
Knobloch at second base. Yeah,
throwing it over. I can't. Who was the first baseman at that time? You just throw it over his head.
That was probably before Morneau. I don't know, but not about the old Twins, but. Literary Hangover, twitch.tv/literary hangover. Last night I played some Red Dead Redemption while listening to Richard Slotkin's The Fatal Frontier, The Myth of the Frontier in the Age of Industrialization. So we learned about why Custer resonated so forcefully with the American public. And you get to see me fail to break a horse and get eaten by wolves. So check that out.
In that situation, could you be playing against me?
Yeah, I think there's online. There's Red Dead Online. I haven't done much of it, but there is an online version.
If I get a console and I want to play, all right, well, we'll deal with that. All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
That guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up. Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.